Fugitive with Bobby and Kitty. I'm sorry, Kitty and Bobby and Ken. I got to get the sequence correct here. Easily distracted. And if you want it to be Talking Fugitive to include you, you can do so by calling 800-407-KSAV. You can also email talk@ksav.org. Several things to talk about tonight. The featured episode tonight is The Brass Ring, which, if memory serves me correctly, I believe has Angie Dickinson in it. I'm pretty well acquainted with all of these myself. Anyway, to start things off, let's go to the begin at the beginning, and Bobby Neer.
Thank you, Dave. Women, women, women. I can't live with them. My poor wife, Helen. I can't live without them. Every lovely but dysfunctional girlfriend I meet along the way, some want to love me, some try to kill me. What am I supposed to do? That might be Richard Kimball's lament. We often talk about the women in The Fugitive, and tonight is no exception. Season 2's episode, Brass Ring. As I said in my review at the time, I rather like this story. It's kind of dark and gritty and dirty, and there seems to be a lot more going on behind the scenes than we get to see. Kitty and Ken gave it an 8 rating, and I gave it an 8.5. Part of what I like most about it is that, at last, Richard Kimball seems to realize just how lucky he is when the writers throw beautiful women in his path, and his reactions in this episode are wildly out of sync with what we normally see. And, yes, there's a murder story here as well, and we'll get to that shortly. But first, Brass Ring starts out, like most episodes, with Kimball looking for work on the boardwalk of an amusement pier right on the water. He's directed toward a gift shop where there is a job opening, and on his way in the door, as Kitty pointed out in her review, something unusual happens. There is a purse snatching right in front of him. And now, of course, we expect Kimball to chase after the guy, get the purse back, save the day, be the hero, the reluctant hero. Only this time, he just stands there watching. Well, what's the matter with him? Why is he just watching this time? Well, probably because there is something more compelling that demands his attention, and that's Norma Sessions, also known as Angie Dickinson, the owner of the gift shop, who's working behind the counter. Kimball takes one look at her and seems to forget who he is and why he's even there. If you watch this series carefully, you will notice that Kimball often has this pained expression on his face, even while nuzzling one of these lovely ladies, as if to say, oh no, here we go again. Somebody else I should stay away from, only they can't resist me, and I can't resist them. Only this time, that pained expression seems to be accompanied by an even greater pain in a different part of his body, and who can blame him for wanting to do something about it? In his review, Ken mentioned that Kimball, after all this time, needs a woman in his life, and that there seems to be more kissing in this episode than in any other. I say forget the kissing, that amidst all of the grabbing and groping on and off the beach, this is Kimball at his most lustful. For once, he isn't ambivalent about a woman. He seems at last to be about to go for that brass ring. What do you think, Ken? Has Kimball had all he can take of his self-imposed celibacy, or is it all about Angie?
Yeah, he gave up. Yeah, when he saw her in the gift shop, did you notice that little scene they had?
Oh, yeah.
They panned to Kimball's eyes, and he was just gushing. And then Norma, behind the counter, she's trying to not notice, but she's gushing too. And you know what? The audience, you know, we're watching the episode, and we go, wow, these two together. Now, to me, the story, not that great, but the acting is really, really good. And they bring back Robert Duvall, which I disagree. They shouldn't have done that, because he was in Never Wave Goodbye, right?
Yep.
And that was the impression we had of him. Now they bring him back in season two, put him in a wheelchair. He had a great performance. We can talk more about him.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in part two.
But they should have used Raymond Burr. You know why? He was in that series Ironside.
Yes, right.
They should have put Raymond Burr in that character. That would have been good. But
yeah,
anyway,
but Raymond Burr wasn't in Ironside at this point. He was still Perry Mason.
That's true.
Oh, was he? Oh, he didn't start it yet. That's right.
Did you happen to notice that the Robert Duvall in this part still has a little bit left over of his Norwegian accent that he had in Never Wave Goodbye? It's kind of strange, huh? Yeah. He's still talking with an accent.
That storyline there between Kimball and, you know, his character in the wheelchair and how Kimball helps him out and takes care of him, you know, teach him the exercise. That was a really good storyline. I like that. And
but the beginning of this story is all about the heat between
yeah.
Kimball and Norma Sessions.
You think this was David Jansen's favorite episode out of all of them?
Do I think so? Well, according to Kitty, who did a review of the book that David Jansen's real-life wife, Ellie, wrote, he had an affair with Angie Dickinson. So I think there's more here.
I don't know that it was necessarily at this time. I think it might have been later.
I don't know. It doesn't matter. They got to bounce with it at some point, I'm sure. And, of course, then, I mean, Angie Dickinson has a long history of having quite a few men in Hollywood. She's always been very upfront about it, so that would not be that unusual. It's impossible to believe that there wasn't something going on behind the scenes, but this looking back and forth between the two of them is really amazing. Did you notice that right away, Kitty?
Yeah, I did. I mean, obviously, I don't think I was approaching this episode from the same viewpoint that you two were.
Yeah, well, we're guys. That's
but I thought it was pretty good. I mean, it had a very different. I mean, just the whole beginning of it was different because the first thing you see is Kimball walking along the boardwalk. And what struck me initially about this was before he even meets Norma Sessions is the contrast that you see in Kimball's character with everybody else on the boardwalk. It's like he's walking along, and of course he's being very into himself, you know, trying to be inconspicuous. And everybody around him is happy, and it's obviously that boardwalk is a place where young lovers hang out because you saw a lot of people walking past him and kissing each other, and it really set the tone for the episode. I don't think we've ever seen an episode start quite like this one. And then, of course, he's told by the one guy that if he's looking for a job to go to the store that Norma Sessions runs, and you know, and then it's like the lightning bolt, kind of like what you see in The Godfather when Michael Corleone lays eyes on the Italian chick for the first time. But I liked it. I thought the subplot with Kimball helping out her brother Leslie was very well done. I was not particularly thrilled with how the episode ended. I think there was some contrived things in there, but, you know, we can get to that when we look at part two of it.
Well, it just strikes me that when they want to do a story like this, they don't hesitate to do it. I mean, it's the first time, the only time that I can think of in which Kimball seems not the least bit reluctant to do something. I mean, we did a show all about Kimball's many love affairs and why he never closes the deal on any of them. We did that quite a few months ago. And that's a continuing theme, so that when you see this this time, it's a lot different. Now, whether or not they did it because they realized they had Angie Dickinson in there is something that only they know. I think that's a real possibility. And in his review, Ken says they seem to be more interested in that than in the story, and I agree. The story is fairly routine. You pretty much know what's going to happen, but what is Kimball's problem? I mean, he goes on this boardwalk, and he needs to have somebody, they know there's a job anywhere in the area, and he picks the one place that there's a potential killer there looking for somebody to take the rap for a murder he's going to commit. Kimball is remarkable in his ability to find trouble. He could have stopped anywhere, but no, he stops there. And, of course, these two are just looking for somebody to come along who can take the rap for the crime that they intend to commit. And he just puts himself right out there. But, you know, in that beginning scene there that I mentioned that you wrote in your review, how unusual it is to have anybody do anything in front of Kimball and he would just stand there. I mean, there's a purse snatching right in front of him, right on the boardwalk. And who would guess that he wouldn't go leaping out the door and try to catch the guy? I mean, he does that all the time. This time he just stands there and does nothing about it, because when he turns around, he sees Angie Dickinson behind the counter instead. So, you know, I mean, I think that's very, very striking. Then, of course, she introduces him to Robert Duvall, her embittered, angry brother in the back room there, who's paralyzed because of an automobile accident. And it's a good performance. I mean, Duvall can do anything. He's been doing that his entire career. He can be anybody at any time. And I agree, this is a really good performance. He's not really given a whole lot to do in this story. But what he does really has a lot of meaning. Of course, I have to admit that I'm a little bit turned off by the usual thing, which is that right away Kimball looks at him and he decides, well, this guy's paralyzed, but you know what? Maybe he's not paralyzed. Maybe I can get him to walk again. Don't you think that's a little much, that he comes up with these instant cures like this?
Well, you know, again, it all just plays into how Dr. Kimball in this series seems to be very selective with who he treats and how he can just magically cure somebody.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we've seen him stitch up, you know, we've seen him do a C-section and stitch up a gunshot wound, and he has no blood anywhere to be seen. You know, so it really didn't surprise me too much that now he can help somebody walk. You know, I think the writers were trying to put forth there with the character of Leslie was that his main problem was that he just didn't initially want to make the effort. He just didn't seem to...
Yeah, well, that's what I thought. I thought it would have been more realistic if instead of just trying to find out whether he had some sort of hysterical paralysis, if instead he might have just helped him to learn to live with his disability and not give up on life the way he obviously has. He's just sitting there in a wheelchair all day long, hollering at everybody and screaming and being resentful about everything, which is not getting him anywhere. But instead he comes up with this usual cure. I have a question for Ken. Ken, where does Angie Dickinson fit in on this? Is she number three in the series or what?
She's number three. You read my review today, obviously,
yeah,
in our book. Susan Oliver,
right.
Suzanne Pochette, and then Angie. Now, we got to talk about the beach scene, Bob.
Sure.
That's the highlight of the whole episode, really.
Well, there, I think they were trying to do a remake of From Here
right.
to Eternity.
Yeah, right.
But remember the scene, if you've watched it, I've seen it a couple of times. Angie, or Norma there, is talking and talking and talking on the beach, and Kimball's not saying anything. And she's looking at him, and you go, boy, you don't say much, do you? You have nothing to say. And right away I got the impression that all Kimball wanted was a one-night stand.
Oh, yeah.
Right there. And he probably was just fed up with his running all over the country. Here he is on the beach with this gorgeous girl, and all he's thinking is, I just need someone right now. You know, I've
well,
just had it.
It could be, Ken, that he just forgot his lines. We're gonna take a quick time out here, and we'll be right back to talk some more about the brass ring and who won the brass ring. Talking Fugitive here on Retro Radio.
Take a look at corruption. You know, it ranges all the way from petty political larceny to grand government theft. And as far as corruption is concerned, I want to make this one point very clear. I worked for the government for 9 months during 1942. Mrs. Nixon worked for the government in San Francisco while I was in service overseas. I am proud of the fact that I once worked for the federal government. I am proud of the millions of fine, good, honest, decent, loyal people that work for the federal government. And I say that the best thing that can be done for them is to kick out the crooks and the others that have besmirched their reputations in Washington, D.C., and that's what we're going to do.
Select the Eisenhower-Nixon team on November 4th.
Oh, I like that one. That Nixon Eisner, that sounds like they're going to get the corruption out of Washington, D.C. I believe that. The most corruption they got out of there was when they left. Okay, we're talking serious stuff, though. The Fugitive, the episode The Brass Ring, and let's return to Bobby Neer.
Okay, in season one, The Hunted, that's Richard Kimball, goes home, that's back to Stafford, Indiana, to visit his family, Sister Donna, Brother Ray, and his ailing father. It's a classic episode, but for every side of a family, there's usually another side. And in season two, Kimball gets to meet the parents, the Waverleys. That's Helen's family, also known as the Survivors. Helen's grieving mother, her bankrupt father, and her younger sister. What do you know? She's yet another woman secretly in love with Kimball. It's another Fugitive classic, The Survivors, 2 weeks from tonight on Talking Fugitive. I would also like to point out that as we approach the 40th anniversary of the end of the series, The Fugitive has finally been released on DVD. Well, at least the first 15 episodes of Season 1 have. Some people have received copies the past 2 days and have posted to our group and others on the Internet that they are very impressed, even ecstatic, about how it all looks. So at last, our long national nightmare is over and everyone can own a piece of Richard Kimball. But if you do, don't forget, that's only part of the Fugitive experience. If you want the whole deal, make sure you also pick up a copy of The Fugitive Views and Reviews, Volume 1, Season 1, which contains a detailed analysis by the foremost fugitive experts in the world, that's us, of those first 15 episodes, along with the back 15 of Season 1. So when they release those to the public, you won't have to buy the book again, and instead you can purchase Volume 2, Season 2. And both are now available at Amazon and Barnes & Noble and many other places on the Internet. So don't forget to pick up a copy when you start your DVD Fugitive collection. But we hope to also have Volume 3, Season 3, available in time for the holiday season later this year.
Bob, I got a question about the DVD.
Yes, sir.
One of the DVD reporters on my program has complained that some companies are putting out the syndicated versions rather than the full-length versions. Which ones are The Fugitive? Which
I don't have it. What I read so far today is that the episodes are running 51 minutes.
Well, that trip must be the full length. Then.
Right. So as far as I know, this one, I think it's put out by Paramount, I think. I haven't seen any complaints so far. So
good.
Apparently, although I said something funny did happen today. Somebody posted there was a review, I believe, in a paper in Chicago that this had come out, and they called The Fugitive a story where the one-armed man pursues Kimball around the country. I think they got a little backwards on that.
They need to tune in here.
Oh, yeah. So if you're going to get those DVDs, get our book, because Fugitive DVDs, without The Fugitive Views and Reviews as a guide, is absolutely unthinkable. And now we have an email sent into the show this evening from Linda, who has something to say about Brass Ring. Kitty?
Okay, Linda says, this is one of my favorite episodes, but not because of Angie Dickinson. Frankly, I thought anyone that beautiful should have easily been able to find a better boyfriend than the one she had. It's not surprising that Kimball fell for her charms, only to be shocked when she hinted that he could assist her in doing away with her brother. The part of the invalid brother was what made this episode special for me. Robert Duvall did an excellent job portraying this bitter man who was given a new lease on life by his contact with Dr. Kimball. The scene where Kimball found him murdered was doubly terrible, not only because Kimball would be blamed, but because this man who had so recently regained his life had had it cruelly snuffed out.
Well, I have to say that I don't agree with that. Actually, listen, I have nothing against her brother there. It is a pity that after having been sitting in that wheelchair for so long, Kimball gives him new hope, gets him to move around, that he ends up getting murdered. But for once, I thought it was rather refreshing that Richard Kimball could not change history. Because every episode, it seems, he gets in there in time and he stops somebody from getting murdered or something happens. This is a failure on his part. It's not his fault. He doesn't really know exactly what they're up to. But he's not able to stop him from getting murdered. That's a little unusual, too.
Well, and I don't think she hinted to Richard that he could assist her in doing away with her brother. did she? I mean,
I don't remember.
Yeah,
that.
I thought the whole plot was that she and the other guy were plotting to kill Leslie and make it look like he did it.
I think the only hint that Kimball would have had would have been the fact that her brother is Leslie. Is that his name?
Leslie. Yeah.
That he was. Didn't he tell Kimball that she's trying to kill me or she's trying to get rid of me or something?
I thought he said something to the effect
that
she was no good, that his, you know, that his sister was not somebody to be trusted.
Ken, do you remember that?
Yeah, that's exactly what he said.
Right.
That, don't trust Norma. He told Kimball that.
Right.
And Kimball should have taken all that money, right? Remember the money scene? Wow.
Well, so how do you think about it? How do you feel about that? Are you sorry to see him go or what?
Me?
Yeah.
I did not like Leslie dying in the end. I said that in the review.
Uh-huh.
And also, I didn't like Norma being carted away to jail either. That kind of disappointed me. I wanted her to kind of, you know, save the day in the end.
Well, I was going to bring that up. You said you didn't like the film. So let's skip for a minute to the end where the police come and arrest Norma because,
She ends up confessing.
And they pass each other on the steps there. And you said you didn't like that, that it kind of fell flat. So what do you want to see instead? What's the alternate?
Well, I wanted her to save the day in the end and expose Lars. And then I wanted her to kind of make up with her brother. And then
really?
She finds out the truth. Or actually, Kimball tells her, hey, I got to leave. And I don't like the murder plot, and then they try to blame it on Kimball. That's kind of rehashed. And
it was
kind of a dud. You know when she walked down the steps? I thought that was the most awful scene I've really ever seen. She walks down slowly. Kimball's there. She looks at him, kind of a bleeding heart. Kimball, he's just a nobody. And Kimball's not going to run away with her, you know? This is just a one- or two-night thing, and then he's got to keep moving on. So what was the point of the whole walking down the steps? Are we, the audience, supposed to feel sorry that these two are not to be together anymore? I mean,
no, what I got from it was the fact that at the beginning, they were looking for somebody to take the rap, and that she really did start to have feelings for him, I think. Feel
sorry for
who?
Norma?
Do I feel sorry for her? No.
No, I didn't feel sorry for her either. I don't necessarily agree with Linda that when she says anyone that beautiful should have easily been able to find a better boyfriend. Well, in the final analysis, Norma was kind of scum. I mean, I don't know, if Dr. Kimball were not on the run and he was, you know, working as a doctor, would Norma really be the kind of woman that he would want to be seen with in public or want to associate with?
Yeah, but this
probably not.
But this is not a love story. This is a lust story. There's two different things here.
I just kind of think that under normal circumstances, I'm not so sure he would have lowered his standards like that.
Well, I agree. And, well, let's go back for a minute because we touched on this together while during the break, and that is that Ken talked about the scene when they're together on the beach and they recreate, of course, the famous scene, as you said, from Mirror to Eternity. Later on, in the latter part of the story, I think there's a much hotter scene than that, and that's when Kimball is in her room with her, with Angie Dickinson, with Norma, and she's kind of lounging back on this couch there overlooking the boardwalk. And he's sitting right there on the edge of the seat, and he's hovering over her. She's wearing a bathrobe. I don't know that there's anything going underneath of it. Probably not. And, I mean, he's giving a lot of looks to her. He really is. I think that he's about to do something there. So I don't think it says anything to do with love at all. And the writer makes that clear at the beginning when he has him walk in the door and look at her that way and go, oh, that's one of those stories. It doesn't have anything. And this is not a love. This is not Karen. This is none of that jazz. I mean, it's just, he's just looking for that. I want to ask Ken something, and I won't ask this of Kitty because she wouldn't have noticed this, but did you happen to notice, Ken, that especially in the beach scene, that we all know what a sensational body that Angie Dickinson always had? By the way, she's 76 years old now, and she probably still has one. And actually, David Jansen is showing more cleavage in this episode than she is. I mean, his shirt is all the way open, more so than it ever is.
She's wearing
this very conservative kind of dress that's buttoned all the way up to her nose there, and of course it's very tight, but still.
How many takes do you think they had? Maybe 10 takes.
Oh, I think they wanted as many takes as they could possibly, yeah.
You know what? I saw Angie Dickinson on Larry King, and Larry King asked her.
Was this recently?
No, this was maybe about a year ago or whatever.
Well, how did she look? She's in her 70s.
She looked great.
Really?
But Larry King asked her about David Jansen.
Oh, really?
Yes, he did.
Really?
And she said, oh, he was wonderful to work with, and she loved him, and
he
was a great actor and all.
Huh?
So I think the whole point of this episode and this story in the whole series is just to get these two together and have the audience just kind of Google.
Oh, I agree.
The whole time, and you know what? It is a memorable episode, and that's why I gave it an 8, because Angie was great. She was really good. All her expressions.
Oh, I agree. I think the story is definitely secondary. Because it is kind of an unremarkable story, like you said. I mean, there've been endless. This is episode 46. It's only a year and a half into the series, and already there have been numerous episodes in which people have looked at Kimball and said, "Oh, this is a great chance. We'll kill so and so. We'll take the money. He'll take the rap. He's got nothing to lose." Stuff like that. So we see that over and over again. So I think that they put a story in there. A mild story, because they couldn't just, well, they didn't feel they could just do a story in which he was pursuing this woman, but I just think that, you know. So I'm a little bit, I see that you're still on your same kick there about not wanting Robert Duvall in here. It's still bothering you that people are coming back.
No, I didn't like it. Did you?
Well, see, it doesn't bother me the way it does you. It doesn't bother
I mean,
you.
I don't care.
What?
You know, the only time it's really bothered me was when Andrew Prine came back and played that scummy character.
One minute.
But, you know, and when Pat Hingle came back and played that scummy character.
Right.
Otherwise, I don't even think about it.
It would have bothered me to see Susan Oliver come back. You can't bring back memorable characters. You know, in Never Wave Goodbye, Robert Duvall is kind of a minor part.
Yeah,
he doesn't really do a whole lot.
Should they have brought Angie Dickinson back in season 3 or 4? That's a question.
Well, just for the visual content,
yeah.
Just to look at her, sure.
Yeah, they could have done that. Yeah.
Yeah, I figured that wouldn't bother you.
No,
but other than that,
run out of time, Bob, she is up on the Wall of Fame in my office, along with the other fugitives.
Oh, okay. Absolutely.
I knew you were wondering about that.
Oh, I don't have to wonder. I know she's there. All righty.
So,
she's got to be there. By the way, is her picture bigger than anybody else's?
No, Susan is number one. Susan Oliver.
Okay. How many women are there all together?
Got about, all the memorable ones.
Did your wife know about this wall, Ken?
I want to know if his wife is on there.
Didn't have room.
Oh,
my wife's on the other side. On the other side of the office.
Oh yeah, sure.
In 2 weeks, we're going to return to see whichever of us here are survivors.
The survivors.
And we'll be talking about the Sosa, the survivors.
Right.
That'll be August the 28th. Hopefully, all of you will be back then as well. We'll continue to talk more Fugitive here on Sheravision Radio.